The latest data shows more progress is needed to close the gap, with only 4 of the 19 targets designed to improve outcomes for First Nations Australians on track. In fact, 4 of the targets are actually going backwards. The Productivity Commission has found worsening outcomes in Indigenous early childhood development, increased numbers of adults in prison, rises in children in out-of-care home, and an increase in Indigenous suicide. Let's talk about those suicide numbers now with Dr. Tracy Westerman. She spent more than 2 decades working with Aboriginal communities to reduce the burden of mental ill health and suicide. She's the founder, actually, of Indigenous Psychological Services. And she joins us now on ABC News Radio. Good morning to you, Doctor.
Good morning, Chris. Thanks for having me on the show.
Well, thanks for coming on. Look, the issue of Indigenous suicide was raised in November last year. It was raised before that, of course, but it was raised last year. In the first Closing the Gap report since the national agreement on closing the gap, I mean, outside of worsening statistics, has anything changed since then? What has changed since then?
Oh, look, I mean, it's good that you've actually raised the fact that suicide was only put in the Close the Gap targets 2 years ago, because frankly, it is unacceptable that we have a suicide rate that's now for decades been at least double that of non-Indigenous Australia. But most heartbreakingly, we have a Indigenous child suicide rate that's 6 times that of non-Indigenous children. So the fact that this has only just been put in the Close the Gap targets, you know, essentially what it says to bereaved Indigenous parents is that suicides are not a priority for us, and they clearly are. I guess what's changed? Well, I've spent a lot of time being, you know, as good as I possibly can be technically at understanding complex issues like suicide, incarceration rates, child removals, and we're just simply not focusing on explaining the why of the overrepresentation. Now, what I mean by that, Chris, is that we constantly have these annual reports that come out that basically just track demographic data. So those things, as a psychologist, like how many children are being removed, how many children are dying by suicide, this is just demographic data that gets tracked every year. And essentially those things, as a psychologist, aren't explaining the why of the overrepresentation. And what I mean by that are causal pathways. And causal pathways are critical as psychologists because these are the things that are therapeutically alterable and trackable that actually give us our best opportunity of reducing all of these, you know, escalating rates. So really it comes down to the fact that we're just not collecting the data in a way that's actually meaningful and treatable.
Right. Okay. Let me see if I've understood you right there. So you can see the figures in front of you and they show that Indigenous suicide rates are going up, but they don't really give you an idea of why, because they don't they don't give the circumstances around each case. Do you have any idea why they might be going up?
Yeah, because in 2003, I actually developed the world's first culturally and clinically validated screening tool to identify Aboriginal people at risk of suicide. Now, what that enabled us to do is actually for the first time, not just in Australia, but also globally, was unpack the why, which are the unique characteristics that explain why Aboriginal people are dying by suicide at a much higher rate than non-Indigenous people. Now, causal pathways explain the why. Now, the reason why they're critical is because the why informs the what to do, just to make something really complex, simple for your audiences to understand. So essentially what we know is that Indigenous people are dying by suicide for different reasons. In fact, what we know is that our suicides are mostly based on, are mostly quite impulsive, and they're highly reactive to interpersonal conflict and crisis. Now what that essentially means is we're looking at a cohort of high-risk people that mostly have trauma and compromised attachment. So essentially what happens is people go from 0 to 1,000 very quickly. It's very common with people who have trauma and compromised attachment. And so what that really means is that people lack self-soothing strategies. So if we know that, we then understand, okay, how do we actually treat those causal pathways? We teach people distress tolerance skills. We teach people effective communication skills. This is a very, very different set of risk indicators and causal pathways to what we're seeing in mainstream populations, which tend to be more around depression and, you know, comorbid with alcohol and drug use. So we're simply just not applying, you know, the best available science to unpack the causes and then determine treatments of best practice so that we can be really clear about what's working, and we're gathering robust data about what's working.
Why aren't we, though? It sounds like you've got some pretty good answers here. It sounds like you've looked at this and found that there are differences, and that you can you could possibly target those differences if you were able to.
Yeah, essentially, Chris, I mean, I've got no answer there. I've never been invited to a Close the Gap meeting. There's been $9.5 million worth of Indigenous suicide prevention, mental health reviews, and all of my work's been excluded from that. So essentially, I guess there is a question that needs to be asked here as to why that's actually occurring and continuing to occur. I'm a woman from the Pilbara. I've dedicated my entire life to this issue, and there are very few of us that actually have this subject matter expertise. So I guess people just need to step back and be objective about getting people around the table who have actual track records for suicide prevention outcomes. Now, about 3 years ago, I actually founded a charity, the Western and Julia Institute for Indigenous Mental Health. And we are actually doing all this by self-funding. We still have not one cent of federal government funding for any of this complex stuff. And that's fine. You know, I guess when you're looking at a suicide rate as high as it is, money starts to become irrelevant to that outcome.
Okay, if they're not talking to you, who are they talking to?
Oh, look, I guess, you know, there are, you know, I don't know, because I'm not sort of in that group of people. But I guess you see, at the end of the day, people should be stepping back and actually looking at or being objective about who's actually capable of the outcomes. So I'm not on that list of people. And I don't, you know, that's not something that I guess I'm not really interested in politics. Suicide and politics don't belong in a sentence. What I'm actually interested in, though, is what are the sorts of things that we can objectively know give us our best opportunity of preventing suicides. We shouldn't have a reality in which 10-year-old kids, and that's what we're talking about here, Chris. We're talking about 10-year-old young children in our communities who are choosing the option of death instead of life. So we should be having every single person around the table who has any and opportunities of us ensuring that this doesn't occur into the future.
Yeah, indeed. Look, I don't want to get involved in the politics of it either at the moment, but I just want to wrap something up. I just want to, have you asked to be involved in those discussions at the highest political level where they sit round and talk about closing the gap?
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, I think the other thing, though, is that there is actually a responsibility here that when you actually determine best practice, what that means is you undertake research and literature reviews on who's actually got publications or has actually got a track record on showing suicide risk reduction. And you're probably talking about a puddle of people. So in terms of, there is a responsibility here on behalf of people who are being paid to determine best practice, to actually determine best practice. Mm. And so if that's not occurring, that's really a better question to be asking.
I understand. They should be coming to you rather than you having to go to them. Okay, but that is the political background to this. And like you say, you want to talk about the actual more important issue. And I was interested what you said there about the differences in Indigenous suicide. And you talked about the impulsiveness of it. What do you, could you tell us what you mean by that? Explain.
Yeah, I guess what we know, so the origin of it is forced removal. So when you actually have removal from primary attachment figures in terms of parents, what that then means is it compromises your own ability to attach and formulate healthy attachments in your own adult relationships, as well as, you know, just relationships generally. So essentially what you're talking about here is you have that pre-existing vulnerability, and then you have ongoing child removals that really mean that that vulnerability is just being generationally concretized over time. And what people who have compromised attachment tend to look like are exactly that, that people really struggle with interpersonal conflict. They struggle with, I guess, you know, things like romantic rejection or even interpersonal conflict. So people can't step outside of emotion, access high-level thinking, effectively communicate and develop these things called self-soothing strategies because they haven't had those things modelled in their upbringing or in their core attachments because they've been lost. So how we fix that is that we teach people those sorts of skills to ensure that, you know, they actually have those skills to reduce, you know, reactivity and decrease the likelihood of people acting impulsively and reacting, you know, when they're not able to step outside of emotion. So I guess that's why it's really important that we're able to unpack causal pathways, because no one has actually done this in Australia, but also internationally. People just assume that our risk indicators are the same as the non-Indigenous suicides. But essentially, how I started the conversation was that what we should be doing is explaining why Aboriginal people are so overrepresented. So some of it is obviously in the fact that the risk factors look different, but then the next bit is the fact that people aren't being trained, and I'm talking about practitioners at the grassroots and ground level. This stuff is incredibly complex, and so what they don't have is, complex trauma and therapies and interventions that are able to capable of going into those really high-risk communities and teaching people on the ground, but also, responding to high-risk cohorts in a way that is actually preventative.
Yeah, no, I get it. People wouldn't recognise it even if it was sat in front of them, kind of thing, is one of the
Correct,
things
yeah.
you're saying here.
Yeah.
I just wonder
Yeah.
how easy would it be, given that you've identified some of these factors, these risk factors, how easy would it be to go out into the community, teach the experts how to recognise it, how to deal with it, and also offer the people at risk help in order to
Oh,
make
pretty
it
easy.
pretty easy?
It's pretty easy. I mean, I've already been doing it in IPS, my company. I've trained 50,000 practitioners across Australia in this in the last 20 years. Also, in my psychometric tools, we've just last week, and this is all through self-funding, I should say, too, Chris, we've actually got the first database, national database of Indigenous mental health and suicide prevention of 266 Aboriginal youth, all through self-funding. So the other thing that we've now done last week is just digitise these tools, which basically means that we're going to be able to capture data in real time for the first time. The next thing we're doing is I've donated all the intellectual property of my programs so that we can go into our highest risk regions, which are the Kimberley, parts of the Northern Territory, and parts of far north Queensland. So essentially what we'd be doing is just training up people locally, because local people never leave. And so the principle is that we're building up capacity in those highest risk communities that carry the burden of the suicides. And then over time, what we're trying to do is work ourselves out of a job. Now, this is something I guess that, I've been doing for a few decades. So when I say it's pretty easy, what I mean is that I've been doing this a long time. It's not my first rodeo, And it's complex for most people. However, when you're going into high-risk communities and you've got a track record of doing that, then it becomes pretty easy. So it's really about, what I'm trying to do is skill up people so that I work myself out of a job. And that means, those communities that I see are more burdened than other communities because they do separate themselves out.
Yeah, no, I get it. I just a last question, just briefly, Doctor. Who needs to have listened to the conversation we've just had in government in order for them to take action on what you've said?
Look, I guess Anthony Albanese is probably the most obvious
Yeah.
starting point. Let's start from the top. And I guess Linda Burney, it would be great to, basically sit down and have a conversation with her about, issues around suicide prevention, mental health prevention, incarceration rates. And also, I guess the big thing is my Djillia Institute is now funding 41 Indigenous psychology students through self-funding. Which and that's really critical because they all come from high-risk communities. So it would be really great to get some federal support for this at the moment. I think we've raised now about $9 million in commitments, and we run concerts. We get funding through public donations, and it will be really. I mean, that makes it really hard because the rollout becomes limited by the fact that you're reliant on public funding. I actually work for no salary and fund a scholarship myself. So, this is the sort of thing I guess that is should be a no-brainer for federal governments to get behind.
Okay, well, perhaps we'll email the offices of Anthony Albanese and Linda Burney and see if we get a response and ask them to have a listen to this conversation and see what they make of it. Dr. Tracy Westerman, thank you so much for your time. Appreciate it.
Beautiful. Thanks, Chris. Thanks for the time.